This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by listeners like you and listeners like Susan H., who, thanks to her donation, is able to compel me to live tweet the property of her choosing. Susan has selected the unsettling HBO doc, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, which I covered in episode 39, and we'd love you to rewatch with us. October 13th in the evening, time to be confirmed. Thank you again for your support, friends, and you can join the ranks of Blotter tipsters yourself at patreon.com/blotterpresents. In other scheduling news, I'll be taking Greenwood Cemetery's trolley tour featuring some of its more infamous residents. The Scandals, Scalawags, and Murder Most Foul tour takes place on November 17th. If you're in the NYC area and want to come along, ticket info is on the Greenwood website, and I will link to that in today's show notes. And finally, I'll also be at the Inside the Staircase and Making a Murderer event at the Gramercy Theater on January 11th, 2019. This one features defense attorneys David Rudolph and Jerry Buting, whose name I am still having trouble saying or spelling correctly on the first pass because it's one letter off from my own. But anyway, if you're local and heading to this one, come over and say hello. If you're not local, they do have other cities planned. I think the Richmond event was supposed to be last week and got moved to December thanks to Hurricane Florence. So if you beat me to this, let me know what you thought. And now, the episode proper.
The starkest example we saw of this was the sentencing of a guy named Rayshon Ellis. Rayshon was 31. He'd been a defendant in many cases ever since he was a teenager. Some charges he'd beat, some he hadn't. And the year before, he'd picked up a new case, or caught a new case, is what everyone says, as if it's a virus. Anyway.
You probably haven't heard anything about this, but Serial is back for season 3. Some of the heralded podcast's less appealing qualities have also returned, and Stephanie Green returns to this podcast to discuss those, the third season's format, and whether that Sarah maybe doesn't have enough people gut-checking her editorially. Later, we'll talk about a new gold standard in white-collar crime reporting, John Carreyrou's banger account of Theranos having no clothes, Bad Blood. Look for the genuine baritone seal of approval on The Blotter Presents, episode 70. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about crime can be really good. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined once again by Stephanie Green. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Sarah.
I am so glad that you could come back and talk about Serial Season 3 because you have been on theblotter.com's, our like premier Serial analyzer and correspondent.
So, it's a vaunted title.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's got to do it. And I'm glad that it was you. So, yes, as y'all may have heard, Serial is back. It probably was the most wanted podcast, like in the history of podcasts, but certainly in its third season. So here is the case file of what Sarah Koenig et al. Are up to in season 3, per The Hollywood Reporter. Quote, new season, new intro. Koenig welcomes listeners to the latest season by adopting the podcast's familiar one story told week by week tagline with a season-specific twist. From This American Life and WBEZ Chicago, it's Serial, Koenig says, one courthouse told week by week. This is a pretty smart way to develop a true crime podcast season, I think. A story or stories will come to you almost in spite of you. This is not a new idea. Joe McGinnis took a run at it with 15 Gothic Street, which only got as far as two Kindle singles before, I presume, he got sick. And unfortunately, like baseball, this particular kind of on-the-ground reporting by drop-ins slash embeddeds who take an anthropological tone with their subjects is easy to not get wrong exactly, but overwrite or get tangled up in tonally, in baseball's case, because the dramatic narrative is baked right into the game's rules and doesn't need underlining, but that underlining often is hard to resist. Serial's third season topic and framework may present the same problem, as may the high profile of its host and what may be her colleagues' reluctance to push back on some of her cringeworthier narrative ideas. We will get into it. First of all, Stephanie, do you want to just give the listeners kind of a nutshell of what you thought of seasons 1 and 2, either comparatively or overall?
Okay. Yeah, season 1 I listened to as soon as it dropped. I was in New Zealand and listened to it kind of in a media vacuum, which I think is the right way to listen to Serial. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was novel and the reporting was interesting, although she tended to get way in over her head in terms of trying to untangle the legal arguments involved. I thought she admits she's not a lawyer, but she gets particularly confused, it seemed like, in her reporting. And by the end of season 1, I was annoyed by her wishy-washiness about, like, well, I don't know if he did it or whatever. It's like, just take a stand, you know? Right. Like, what's the point of spending this long trying to analyze the story? And if you're putting yourself in the center of it, you should be, you know, ballsy enough to be able to say one way or the other what you think.
Right. Well, so I think you were one of the few people that, even at that point, that I knew who was like, I'm pretty sure Adnan is guilty.
Yeah, I'm like a not non-truther, I guess. I think he did it. But, you know, I don't know. That's just my feeling. I always, you know, I always think they're guilty. C.E.G. The staircase. But
but the owl. But the owl's emails. Just kidding. Anyway, continue.
But the owl. So anyway, that was season 1. And then season 2, I hated.
Really?
Because, well, I didn't hate listening to it. I just hated Bergdahl. I was like, I don't care. I don't need someone to, like, champion like this particular dude's story. It's an interesting story, but the tack she took was like, well, he was just troubled and blah blah blah, and it's like, okay, but this kind of goes to my larger problem with Sarah Koenig. Like, she picks the people she chooses to champion, like, in a mealy-mouthed, half-hearted way. I'm like, why are you picking that person? You know, it's just kind of weird. Like,
well, I think my thing with season 2 was like, I think maybe this is like adjacent to what you're saying. One of my issues, like, I thought the storytelling was good, and I thought she took maybe an unfair amount of clip for it not being the same kind of like justice for X who done it. But the problem was, I think that's how she like put herself into the story. Not put herself into the story, but that's how she got into the story. It was like maybe looking for someone who was being, like, you know, unfairly or overly punished. And then when it turned out to be a little bit different, the narrative itself turned out to be a little bit different. Then mm-hmm. she didn't sort of go back and adjust her storytelling retroactively.
Yes.
And I am very sympathetic to the like editorial constraints that might have made it difficult for her to do that, but I still felt like, I mean, not that this is a bad story, but I'm not sure this is the on brand.
Yeah, and part of, you know, those editorial choices is picking which story to tell, and then, you know, if you can't tell the story effectively in the medium or length of podcast you've chosen, then like switch it up. You have to correct course. And then season 3 kind of takes the worst of what I think her tendencies are, at least episode 1 does.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Amplifies them. Episode 2 I found much more compelling and less obnoxious than episode 1. But I mean, we'll talk about this, but episode 1 was it was hard for me not to stop listening to it, like, 4 minutes in. I mean, it was really
Really like, you, I think we started at around the same time, and you and I were texting about it, and the clips that you called for that are coming up were things that I had in my notes just like triple underlined and like a lot of capital lettered swears in my notes, and just long like groans in my notes that were like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I was cringing, and then I had to stop and do something else for another job, and so you got ahead of me and reassured me that episode two was better, which it is. I agree. But, oh, man, like, all right, why don't we just get into it with a few of these clips? I clustered some of them together because they all illustrate the same problem. Clip two, which we're about to hear, is a bit longer than we usually go, but to get the full, like, mercilessly, oh, Sarah, effect, I really feel that we did need the whole thing. Here's clip two.
The elevator mainstays, of course, are crime victims and their families, and defendants and their families. Sometimes those families are one and the same. When I'm feeling optimistic, I appreciate that an elevator car in a government building is one of the few places left in our country where different kinds of people are forced into proximity. I like to think that we can all stand so close to one another, with our sensible heels and Timberland boots and American flag lapel pins and fake eyelashes and Axe cologne and orthopedic inserts and teardrop tattoos and to-go coffees. And when the elevator doors open up, spilling us out onto our floor, the fact that no one is bloodied or even in tears, it's a small, pleasing reminder that we're all in this together. Other times, the shoulder-to-shoulder closeness only magnifies the obvious. We're not the same. Not at all. Coming up from the lobby one morning, a young black woman is holding a little portable speaker. The white people in the elevator give each other looks. I don't want to reciprocate their looks. Instead, I decide it's my duty to break the tension by saying the lamest thing I possibly can. To be clear, that wasn't my plan. It's just what came naturally to me, apparently.
Put a soundtrack for the elevator. Not like your Muzak you usually get.
She doesn't even bother with a mm-hmm this time. Now I keep my head down to avoid the looks the black people are probably giving each other.
Yeah, oh my, where do I even start? Do you want to start? I mean, even
yes.
The music is like, ugh.
The like jaunty piano.
If you tried
strings.
To do a parody of what this would be like, knowing nothing but the subject matter, I feel like it would be this. But please go ahead while I
It would probably be more sensitive than this.
Well, one would hope.
She's so universally condescending of everyone. You know, you can just tell that she's this, like, observer, and she observes everyone with her gimlet eye. But she sort of chooses very efficient ways to kind of dismiss people, like American flag lapel pin, fake eyelashes, teardrop tattoo. Like, these are ways of sort of labeling people in a way where we get the picture of what she's saying. You know what I mean? And then she has to be like the wokest white woman, but she does it in this way that is so cringy that I can't even... It's cringy, and it's also like, okay, so the lady in the elevator blasting music, that's rude.
Yeah.
First of all, that's rude. Like, if I were in the elevator, I would be one of those people, like, exchanging looks, because I hate when people do that. And she's like, I don't want to reciprocate the white people's looks. And I'm like, wait, but you're just ass backwards on this, Sarah. Like, she's like white knighting this woman, like blasting music in an elevator, but she seems completely deaf to big issues that she should be more sensitive towards. Like, yeah, people are being polite in an elevator, but people are suffering in this building, you know, like, just because people maintain a semblance of, I don't know, civility in an elevator doesn't mean that everything's fine or that, you know, it's easy for example, crime victims to be in the same elevator as the person who's accused of hurting them or their family members or whatever. And she manages to just sort of skip the big issues, focus on the small ones, and piss me off very quickly in the first, like, 4 minutes of this podcast.
Yeah, that's, agree. But that's one of the few things that I didn't have on my list of why this was off-putting, is that she's like glossing over the pain in the building in favor of this cutesy shorthand, which it's overwritten. Like, I wrote up my adventures on jury duty for Tomato Nation in, I'm gonna say, 96. It was like one of the first things I ever wrote on the internet. I mean, it wasn't great, but like the elevator, at least in New York criminal courts, is like you're waiting for half an hour. It's huge. It's like this huge people mover. Yeah. There's 50 people on it. And I mean, it is like that. It is like the great cross section of humanity. But just say that, that it's this great equalizer where everybody has to, you know, deal with it or take the stairs and then move on to something else. Like there's just, and she's obviously so pleased with it too, that mm-hmm. she's like, and teardrop tattoos, like, oh, I get it. Like,
yeah. Mm. And she loves this device she's chosen. And like you said, it lasts way too long. She tries to, I think she sees herself as like this affable fly on the wall who's like quickly becomes part of the scene and she knows everyone and blah, blah. And I'm like, ugh, I'm sure you're an annoyance to everyone in that elevator. You're like the uniting factor. They can all like grumble about you behind your back.
It, bless your heart. Someone's got to do it. But I and mean, the I just don't understand. Like, I understand why the, you know, the exchange was included because she wants to make herself relatable. And but first of all, the way she does it is something that in a, you know, adult woman who is premier in her field, I don't think that like, ha ha, like I'm a, you know, goofy and do stupid shit just like you. Like you're a reporter who like pioneered an entire field of reporting. Please don't. I just don't think that necessarily a dude would do the same thing or expect people to find it like daffy and likable. Like it,
cutesy.
It's just unprofessional and strained. And I really don't understand why someone, anyone, didn't say like, I don't think you need this. Anything to get it taken out.
Yeah.
Because it leaves a very, this is in the first 5 minutes and the bad taste lingers for the next 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. The whole first episode, I mean, I have in my notes like 25 minutes into this episode, I'm like, I've learned nothing revealing about, you know, the criminal justice system. And I do not know what I'm supposed to take away from this podcast, you know?
Yeah.
And it kind of limps along for the rest of the way. Like 35 minutes in, they start talking about like the plea deal system and that gets slightly interesting. But then it sort of like stumbles again and comes back to this woman who Koenig has decided, Anna, who's decided is a victim of sentencing, like incorrect sentence. Like what? I don't even know what the takeaway is supposed to be. And we can talk about the details of that case, but I'm like, I don't feel that bad for her. Like... She got a misdemeanor conviction. She beat someone up in a bar and that person like, and she hit a cop, like whether it was intentional or not, like, you know, there are consequences for that, whether you agree with that or not.
Well, and,
I just don't understand like what are we supposed to take away from this? Like, she's like, it's really hard on her. She had to pay a fine and she has to report. It's like, right. That's what happens when you get a record.
Well, like, there's so many ways into that in terms of like, first of all, the vicious cycle that begins for a lot of people, especially lower income to middle class people who cannot afford, who are sort of living on the like razor's edge financially and can't afford to go down to the Justice Center 20 times as Anna had okay. to. Like there are ways to get into this to be like this system is like once you start accruing punishments, then it starts to cycle for a lot of people.
But like, don't get into a bar fight then. Oh, I don't know. Am I
no,
an
no, I don't
like,
think. I mean, I agree.
Not...
And we have a clip to illustrate that. But like, there are a bunch of issues in play in this particular case that I don't think Koenig illuminated at all. Or she illuminated things that she didn't maybe mean to illuminate. Or maybe you and I are just old, you know, get off my lawn type people.
Oh, yeah, admit it.
But,
totally.
All right. First, let's wrap up our for now, complaints about Koenig's flippancy towards certain rules and regulations of recording in court. Here's clip three.
But anyway, we could have gone to lots of cities and the problems would look about the same. Minneapolis or Atlanta or Pittsburgh or Sacramento. Same sorts of crime, same struggle for fairness, same attempts at reform. In most courts, though, it's really hard to record. You might need permission from the state Supreme Court. Hello, Illinois. In other places, recording of any kind is barred in courtrooms. What is your problem, Pennsylvania? Cleveland, though, they let our producer, Emmanuel Jochi, and me wander the courthouse unencumbered with microphones.
I mean, here we are again. First of all, that was 30 seconds. Just say, why did we pick Cleveland? Because it was representative of the problems of many major cities, and also they would let us record here. See how that works? That was 6 seconds. Come on.
Right.
Second of all, what is your problem, Pennsylvania? What's your fucking problem? It's called respect for privacy. There are a lot of reasons courts don't allow recordings. So off-putting. Almost fatally off-putting, that part. And again, six minutes into it, I was like, I want to kick you. Not that hard, but just like a little, like a nice thump in the shins.
I'm with you.
And the subject of the first episode, and the cutesiness extends to the episode titles, at least so far. Episode one is called The Bar Fight Walks Into the Justice Center. And then the second one, which centers on a judge who, to talk about trying to be woke, yikes.
We'll, oh my God,
we'll get
guy.
To him, but his name is Judge Gall, and the episode title is like, you've got some gall, or you've got some, a lot of galls, or something like that. Like
something.
Just call it Judge Gall's courtroom. You got the job, Sarah. You don't have to try that hard. Mm-hmm. But the first episode concerns Anna's getting into a bar fight because there was a guy. My understanding is that some guy was like just slapping her ass repeatedly. So there was a set to, which a cop tried to break up. And while Anna was flailing, she hit the cop.
Right.
So,
but what happened was, I watched the footage. This dude was harassing her and, I mean, assaulting her. He was touching her. And she kind of, like, was blowing him off and whatever, ignoring him. There's no sound on the security footage, so you can't see or you can't hear what she's saying. And then this other woman gets involved and gets in Anna's face but doesn't touch her. And then Anna goes apeshit on this other woman and starts attacking her, like, crazy. And so people are trying to get Anna off of this woman and she won't stop, and so they're pulling her off and her arm flies back and she like punches a cop. Okay, so what she ends up being charged with is a felony for, you know, assaulting a police officer or something, and then they plea down to a misdemeanor, which is like, I don't even remember what it was, disorderly conduct or something. Which, to me, I'm like, well, that sounds right.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in a bar fight. But Sarah Koenig acts like Anna is this victim of the system. And I'm like, huh. Like, you know, it reminded me of this, I think what it was trying to do, I think it was a This American Life episode years ago that was about the way traffic citations in particular can pile up for it was like traffic and parking citations pile up for people who are poor, and they end up snowballing to the point where it can basically not bankrupt you, but like put you in a permanent state of owing money that you can never, they snowball. So like the later you are in paying them, the more they accrue and whatever. And it was really interesting, and it made you think about the way the system that most of us function in without even thinking about it, like you get a parking ticket, you just pay it, would affect poor people differently and redound, have consequences that would affect other parts of their lives, like their ability to work or whatever. And it was really well done, and it was thought-provoking, and it made you think, okay? I think Sarah Koenig's trying to do that, but she's picking the wrong test case, because when I heard this, I'm like, this seems like, I mean, yeah, I'm sure it is onerous for Anna to like report to the courthouse or whatever. I don't know her financial circumstances, but like, I watched her like beat up a woman. So like, there has to be some consequence for that. It's different than like, oh, I parked in the wrong place, I'm poor, and now I have a million tickets that I can't pay, and now I am like, you know, there's a warrant out for me and I'm not allowed to drive, and I, you know, it's like, it's just different. I'm just not, it's not that I'm not sympathetic to Anna. Everyone makes mistakes, but like, yeah, you gotta pay for those mistakes in some way. And Sarah Koenig seems to be saying, well, because Anna, I don't even know what her reasoning is, because she didn't mean to hit a cop, there shouldn't be any consequences. All charges should have been dismissed. She should have been let go. And I'm like, but why?
Well, and I think she's also like, she makes sure to very sarcastically note that the guy who sort of set off this, like pushed the first domino by slapping her on the ass and harassing her, is, you know, not considered like that. It's not worthwhile to pursue that. And it's like, all right, well, that's unfortunate. But I think that Sarah Koenig like sort of collapses the timeline of cause and effect here. And in clip four, we kind of hear like, again, we were all whatever, 21, and like lit up on cherry schnapps or whatever and did things we shouldn't have. But this again is perhaps not illustrating what it thinks it's illustrating in terms of Anna's relatability. Clip four.
She told me she was a little drunk and very angry sitting in the back of that cruiser.
You got me sitting in a fucking cop car for hours for no fucking reason. Why am I in the back of this car? This is bullshit. Why can't you guys tell me?
Anna loosed a slurry of invective, of protest. For 1 hour, she kept it up. I asked her, how was she not scared to talk to cops like that? She said, I hate to say it, I'm a white girl. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes you can get away with things and you can say things. Do you understand what I'm saying? I did understand what she was saying.
I mean,
our hero, Anna.
Like,
why did Sarah Koenig pick this lady? I just, ugh,
I mean, I guess you could say like a slurry of invective again, overwriting, like just say that she just screamed her head off. I thought the punchline of this, frankly, was going to be that she was yelling and screaming and then she started crying. And in my experience, about 10 seconds into the sobbing is the vomiting. If that happened, we did not hear. Maybe that's why she was mad. She'd puked in the prowler and they wouldn't let her out.
God.
But it's just really like, Anna told me she was a little drunk. Like, that's okay. That's not a little drunk where I come from. If you're like screaming your head off and pounding on the cop car window, but
unless that's just how she is.
Maybe. And
which is also not great.
Yeah. But then, and then after that, we're enlightened as to the fact that this is not Anna's first or even third brush with the law on like just little pissant, you know, early 20s, don't be an idiot shit like this. It's been several states. I think she also kited checks, but they didn't end up charging her, like fully charging her with that. There's an interesting point to be made here related to what you were saying before, I think, about the snowball effect for particularly people of color, but just like generally lower income or marginal income people, that one of these things that they get behind on can turn into, you know, two things, three things.
Is that the case with Anna, though? Because I would like to hear that story, but I don't think that's this story.
I don't think it is this story either, but Sarah Koenig sort of mentions how many times Anna had to go down to the down to the Justice Center, which is like, okay, 20 times over whatever period that is. Like, if you're working the kind of job Anna probably has, you don't have a ton of flexibility in when you can get off work to go to court. And then she has to take a piss test every time. And, you know, that's like, it's intrusive. I'm not saying it's not deserved.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, if you're going to bring that up and act like Anna is being victimized by the probation system, make the connection explicit. Like, how did this affect her working life? She just sort of implies it instead of making the connections, maybe because she feels like this isn't a good example, but she got access to Anna versus someone else. So she's sticking with this version of the story. Well, anyway, it's also an entree into her grand unifying theory of the stink, which we'll hear about in clip 5.
In his heart of hearts, Russ thinks the real reason the prosecutor's office is pursuing this case against Anna is because there was a cop involved, yes, but also because she's already got a record. No felonies, but she's got some misdemeanors. From Florida, there's a driving under suspension, a DUI, then some local convictions, including a recent one, which looks pretty bad, a case that started out as two felony theft charges but got dropped down to misdemeanors. So Anna's not clean. Not that there are a lot of clean records in the Justice Center. Most of the defendants, many of the victims, too, have had some prior entanglement with the law. And even if it's small stuff, marijuana possession or trespassing, you get the stink on you, or what I've come to think of as the stink. You get a whiff of bad citizenry about you, an odor that causes the presumption of innocence to shrivel. Russ understands why. I understand why. It's because everyone who works in this building has become accustomed to the likes of you. You are the usual suspect. And now it feels natural that the courthouse is where you belong.
I mean, again, I think this is an issue, generally, mm-hmm. in our, quote, system of, quote, justice, blah, blah, whatever. But this is not a good example of this, necessarily. Like,
no.
Felony theft?
And now she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Good luck, kid.
Mm,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's depressing, but not for the reasons I think Koenig thinks it is. I mean, I don't know. Like, she does that thing that you were kind of alluding to where she skims over the tops of interesting topics and then doesn't report them or doesn't do the work to, like, make those connections.
Yeah.
She just sort of presents a story and then she presents her theory but doesn't work to fit the story into the theory necessarily.
This is sort of my issue with her, is that, like, she's both intruding into the stories that she's trying to tell and needs to get out of the way, but then she's also not in the stories enough in terms of making those connections and gathering the information that makes it a coherent.
She doesn't do a lot of analysis.
Yeah. Or she does, but it's just like a reanalysis that we already sort of heard, as in clip 6.
A felony judge I was talking to for a different story in this series told me he was thinking of giving a defendant serious time. What's serious time, I asked. He explained, well, to someone with common sense, even one day in jail is devastating, life-changing. To someone who's got no common sense, maybe they do 3 years, 5 years, means nothing. They go right back out and commit more crimes. I knew what he meant. Punishment is relative. What it takes to teach you a lesson depends on what you're used to. But there was a more disturbing implication as well, one that prowls this courthouse and throughout our criminal justice system, that we are not like them. The ones we arrest and punish, the ones with the stink, they're a slightly different species, with senses dulled and toughened. They don't feel pain or sorrow or joy or freedom or the loss of freedom the same way you or I would.
I mean, once again, this is overwritten, and you've already said it, and show us, don't keep telling us. We don't really get into what she's talking about here, I would say, until episode 2,
episode 2, sort of.
And what really prowls the courthouse, I would say, is that, the incarceration complex in this country is creating a permanent, huge underclass of people in a deeply racist way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, I'm sure there are a million examples of like systemic injustice, or not even like gross systemic injustice, but just like little systemic things that conspire against, that might go one way for one type of person and another way for another type of person. But she doesn't pick those cases.
No.
It's like so the clip that we heard, stories.
The clip that we heard at the top. I mean, caught a case, they say, like it's a virus. Like, oh, Koenig, first of all, no. But second of all, like that guy sounds like a much more like classic defendant. Of course, maybe he didn't agree to talk to her, but I don't think there's anything wrong with just presenting the information, you know, that you glean from a day in the courthouse life of these people, and then not necessarily, well, first of all, not picking Anna, but second of all, not sort of coming in with your voiceover to talk about the stink and everything else. Like, I think we could get it if you just reported on these cases.
Show, don't tell, and, like you said.
Yeah.
Basic rule of storytelling.
She is a lot better about that. She is a lot better about that in episode 2, for sure. Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about the greater role of her co-producer?
Yes. Well, there was a lot less Koenig in episode 2, which I appreciated. It was Emmanuel Jochi, I guess, is her producer.
Mm-hmm.
And he does more of the narration. And he does more of the interviews, which I think is good. And also, like, the story, it's still a bit muddled, the story they're trying to tell in episode 2, I thought. Mm-hmm. But the focus on this judge, I think, is like, so it's so interesting because it's nuanced, right? Like, the situation with this judge is nuanced. The judge thinks he's doing the right thing, I think genuinely is trying to do the right thing, but is going about it in sort of a racist, like, ass backwards way.
And it's also very tone deaf, and she does make a point of underlining how often he tries to use like down terminology. It's bad.
Don't. And just like examining the system in which the judge is operating, she goes a little bit into the difference between drug court and you know, the criminal justice system proper. I would want to hear more about that.
Same.
And again, there was a This American Life episode about that, about drug courts. But I'm sorry. I'm like, This American Life did it better.
Well, and you also saw Intervention actually did a whole season or mini season on like the heroin triangle in Georgia. And they had a lot of footage of drug court, which is having to shoulder a huge burden in terms of trying to like cut off even one capillary of the opioid problem anywhere, right, by like returning people to their lives so that families aren't being gutted. But anyway, this is interesting. The practical issues in play here are, I think, maybe more interesting than Daniel Gall's attempts to relate.
Oh my God. I know. And I don't know what you thought about him. I'm like, obviously, like, I find his approach and his way of speaking to people very off-putting and wrong.
Yeah.
But like, I think he genuinely thinks he's doing the right thing. And I think he does genuinely care. And the reporting did convey that nuance. So
yeah,
I appreciated that about episode 2 more than whatever the hell they were trying to do with episode 1.
Yeah. Here's a little snippet of Judge Gall relating our final clip from this section.
That you're pregnant now. Even better. Wonderful. Who's the first baby's daddy?
Judge Gall gave her a couple years probation. This was on a Monday. Over the weekend, Judge Gall had read an article about the percentage of children born on Medicaid. After the Macy's woman left the courtroom, he started talking about it. Anybody see the story in the paper about the percentage of children born in this country on Medicaid? Anybody see this? I don't even want to know, moaned a defense attorney.
I mean, with the moaned defense attorney aside, that's pretty much what you're dealing with, mm-hmm. with Judge Gall. And I thought that this episode did a much better job identifying what is compelling about him, and then mostly letting him be compelling in whatever maddening or, you know, way that might be, and not stepping in too often to be like guiding you towards what to think, or being very This American Life-y about the narration instead of just letting the subject speak for itself. So
yeah,
this was an improvement. I think there's an issue generally at this point with Sarah Koenig in terms of not maybe being a little too big to hear feedback about what's effective, and having internalized her importance in the genre. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to take away from anything that she does do well. And when I finally like bowed to the dozens of people who were like, you really have to start listening to Serial, and started catching up with it, I listened to like eight episodes in a day. Like,
yeah,
she's good at what she does, but man, like that first episode of the third season really, really made it like tough for me to contemplate continuing. It bounced back in the second episode, but I'm still not sure I'm going to keep going, because I'm just not sure that I don't know what's waiting for me and that I am going to like it. Are you going to keep listening to this season?
This will not be on my must listen. You know how there are certain podcasts that pop into your feed and you're like, oh, going to listen to that right away. Mm-hmm. This will probably be one that'll catch some dust or gather some dust in my feed before I listen to it. I'll give episode 3 a chance and then we'll go from there. But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
All right. Shall we move along to our cold case?
Yes.
Okay. Tara Ariano lent me her copy of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup by Wall Street Journal reporter John Carreyrou, based on his reporting on Elizabeth Holmes's vaporware healthcare company Theranos. The case file is, well, I'll just read from the dust jacket. In 2015, Theranos founder and CEO Elizabeth Holmes was widely seen as the female Steve Jobs, a brilliant Stanford dropout whose startup Unicorn promised to revolutionize the medical industry with a machine that would make blood testing significantly faster and easier. Backed by investors such as Larry Ellison and Tim Draper, Theranos sold shares in a fundraising round that valued the company at more than $9 billion, putting Holmes's worth at an estimated $4.5 billion. There was just one problem. The technology didn't work. For years, Holmes had been misleading investors and retail partners such as Safeway and Walgreens, hiding the fact that her technology was flawed and had serious limitations. Meanwhile, Holmes and her partner, Sunny Balwani, fostered a mercurial and highly secretive workplace environment in which Theranos employees routinely saw their colleagues fired for raising red flags. Their deception would lead to nearly 1 million false test results, some of which seriously jeopardized the health of patients. Cool. Good job, Elizabeth Holmes. I have to say that this reads like a thriller.
It really does.
Carreyrou's prose is perfect. Like, once you get to the part where he enters the story, mm-hmm. speaking of himself in the first person, and then is like facing off against, he's like brings in his editor and the Wall Street Journal's attorney, and he's facing off against Holmes's lawyers, all because he sent her a questions list like 58 times. And she's like, well, but you're slandering me. And he's like, well, then why don't you just submit to a fucking interview, you jackass? It really, like, I put a little post-it that was like, this is exciting. Like, it's really exciting. Yeah. I mean, I know what happens in the end, and it's bad for Holmes, but this is not easy. This is not easy to make, to shape this way and keep it this much of a page turner. It's not overwritten at all. He's not like going all Cornwell on it. So when you read this book, Stephanie, had you heard anything about this case, or were you recommended the book based on the book?
I had heard a lot about this case. I am a Stanford 2005 alumna. So I was a year ahead of her. And in fact, some of the people that they interview in the book, I'm like, oh, I know who that is.
Oh.
So that, yeah. But I didn't know her at Stanford because she dropped out, like, you know, right away. So yes, as a Stanford alum, like, this is something I was really aware of. And I remember hearing a lot about her back in, like, her golden days, like, about how she was this genius and revolutionizing healthcare and et cetera. And then I guess the first, like, sort of whiffs in the media about Theranos being in trouble was, like, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when the big articles started coming out? Was that, it was probably the Wall Street Journal article.
Yeah, I think so.
And then I had been following the story since then. And then when I heard about this book, I snapped it up and devoured it. So I don't have a personal interest in the story, but it's Stanford adjacent. So, I have friends who have friends who worked at Theranos, and I find it completely fascinating and horrifying.
It really is. I mean, the story itself, like, it's an excellent story, but then it's really well told as well. Like, he knows how long to sort of stay out of the way. And then once he comes into it, you have all these elements of, like, some of my favorite narrative types. For example, the story about the story. So, like, all the president's men, you have that aspect. You have what a huge con this is. And I'm fascinated by, like, cons, frauds, how Ponzi schemes are made to work, that kind of thing. And I mean, then you have many of the most influential and powerful old white dudes just being like, oh, Elizabeth, she's great. Like,
oh my God, it's unbelievable.
It's so pathetic. It's so pathetic.
One of the quotes that I pulled that I wanted to talk about is about how easily these people were just conned. And man, if you want to run a con, just be like a sort of charming young white girl with blonde hair,
mm-hmm.
and like, we're speaking a weirdly deep voice, and you'll have your way with, like, the glitterati of
the
military and intelligence world.
I know.
And
oh,
science,
General
and
Mattis,
it's crazy.
You idiot.
I know.
Before we get into her weird voice, which we have to. I'm so glad that you made me pull a clip of that. But first, I'm going to read from page 51 about her, like, saleswoman superpowers, apparently, because you read this kind of thing several times in the book. But then once you've heard her voice, you're like, but how? Because she sounds like yeah. She's gargling Hank Williams. But anyway. After some discussion, the four men reached a consensus. They would remove Elizabeth as CEO. She had proven herself too young and inexperienced for the job. Tom Brodeen would step in to lead the company for a temporary period until a more permanent replacement could be found. They called in Elizabeth to confront her with what they had learned and inform her of their decision. But then something extraordinary happened. Over the course of the next 2 hours, Elizabeth convinced them to change their minds. She told them she recognized there were issues with her management and promised to change. She would be more transparent and responsive going forward. It wouldn't happen again. Brodeen wasn't exactly dying to come out of retirement to run a startup in a field in which he had no expertise, so he took a neutral stance and watched as Elizabeth used just the right mix of contrition and charm to gradually win back his three bored colleagues. It was an impressive performance, he thought. A much older and more experienced CEO skilled in the art of corporate infighting would have been hard-pressed to turn the situation around like she had. He was reminded of an old saying, When you strike at the king, you must kill him. Todd Surdy and Michael Esquivel had struck at the king, or rather the queen, but she'd survived. So, yeah. I mean, I just kept thinking of other cases or sort of bullshit con artists that this case reminded me of. Like, not exact parallels, but like Trump. Honestly, mm-hmm. in his real estate empire. Also kind of H.H. Holmes, like that, you know, not that she's a murderous monster, but just this way that he and Trump both had of being like, okay, well, I got this work done and now I'm going to claim that it's done incorrectly and refuse to pay and sue you and slander you. And eventually you'll just get tired of dealing with me. And go away.
Yeah. And, you know, reading this book, especially when things start to kind of spiral for Theranos, the lawyers she had as her attack dogs were some of the true villains of the story, honestly. The one guy, now I've forgotten his name, the head lawyer who she had for a long time.
Boyce? Is that how you pronounce it?
Boyce. I mean, I don't know how that guy sleeps at night. The things he did to antagonize innocent people who were trying to blow the whistle on, not even necessarily blow the whistle, but just trying to leave Theranos. He was ready to ruin people on behalf of this company that was injuring people.
Yeah, there was one, I don't think I have a quote pulled from it, but when that scientist, Ian, took his own life,
killed himself,
probably
yeah.
because of the stress, at least in part, caused by everything going on at Theranos. And then the company's only response is to demand that his widow turn over his work phone and laptop.
It's astounding.
And then they're like, oh, we'll organize a, you know, remembrance. And then they didn't.
A remembrance of the man who we drove to suicide, basically.
Yeah, because he because he had a crisis of conscience and was going to give a deposition against them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really quite amazing that she manages to turn George Shultz, not his new wife, but George Shultz, against his own grandson, who's like, "Are you
crazy?
Kidding me?" And with this voice, no less, here is Holmes on Mad Money shortly. this is transcribed in the book, but I had not heard her voice before cutting this clip. Listeners, what is this? Here's clip 8.
This is Holmes. Welcome back to Mad Money.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth, I have to tell you, in all my years, I can't recall a private company that I have to candidly, many have never heard of, getting this kind of attention and scrutiny. What do you think's going on here?
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world. And I have to say, I personally was shocked to see that the journal would publish something like this.
Shocked. Shocked.
I think what's striking about her voice is that it's so unnatural. I mean, that's not her real voice, you can tell. It's like a kid trying to talk like a grown-up. You know?
Yeah.
And it kind of comes and goes. Like, if you listen longer to any of her interviews, it slowly creeps up in the register, and then she'll recover it and go back down. And it's like, it's just so bizarre. I can't. It's just yet another bizarre layer to this story.
And it just has to be exhausting. I understand how, as a 19-year-old, she would maybe do some, like, vocal exercises or elocution or something to sound more authoritative and not be ending sentences like this. But this is weird.
It's jarring.
Yeah. Like, this is not what I was expecting. I was expecting but it's different. Like, I don't know exactly what it is. It's like it's not even that she's pitching it down. It's like occurring at a different wavelength. That's very odd.
It's very odd, yeah.
But it, I mean, it seems to have worked.
until it didn't.
Yeah. And that little snippet of her saying, well, you know, they just jealous, basically.
Because she's trying to change things, Sarah.
Yeah. By biting Steve Jobs' shit, basically, exclusively. Here's another passage from page 100. Steve Jobs dies October 5th, 2011, and then there's like a mad scramble to find an Apple logo flag to fly at half mast over Theranos headquarters, which is bad enough. So this is taking all day. Quote, in the meantime, work at the company came to a standstill as Elizabeth and Sonny moped around the office, consumed by the hunt for the Apple flag. Greg had been aware of Elizabeth's fascination with Jobs. She referred to him as Steve as if they were close friends. At one point, she told him that a documentary espousing a 9/11 conspiracy theory wouldn't have been available on iTunes if Steve hadn't believed there was something to it. Greg thought that was silly. He was pretty sure Jobs hadn't personally screened all the movies for rent or sale on iTunes. Elizabeth seemed to have this exaggerated image of him as an all-seeing and all-knowing being. A month or two after Jobs' death, some of Greg's colleagues in the engineering department began to notice that Elizabeth was borrowing behaviors and management techniques described in Walter Isaacson's biography of the late Apple founder. They were all reading the book, too, and could pinpoint which chapter she was on based on which period of Jobs' career she was impersonating. Elizabeth even gave the Minilab a Jobs-inspired code name, the 4S. It was a reference to the iPhone 4S, which Apple had coincidentally unveiled the day before Jobs passed away.
Oh,
I mostly read that entire passage because throughout, Carrie Rue's restraint in describing what a... like, to me, in retrospect, obvious and transparent, self-regarding jackass this woman is, he never pushes it too far in terms of those descriptions, which I think is really smart. He lets it sort of build.
Speak for itself.
Yeah. There was maybe like one or two spots where I wanted him to get into more dishy detail. Like, when they're talking about how she met Sonny Balwani, her whatever, CFO slash 20 years older boyfriend slash abusive boss to everyone, that they met on her, like, I guess, language immersion trip to Beijing. And other students on the trip were bullying her, and he was like the only one who would hang out with her. And I'm like, there is a novel in that. Aside, please, will her trip mates please come forward and talk some shit? Because I'm pretty interested. Because I'm petty.
Oh my God.
But yeah, her, yeah. I mean, the Jobsian, she even will sit in a chair the same way that Jobs did. And it's, yeah.
Which, again, is like a child.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a child was allowed to start a company, mm-hmm. you know? And it's all imitation and in the most kind of obvious way, surface level way, without understanding or caring about, you know, the severe health risks that this company is causing.
And the,
I mean, like, it's just so irresponsible. She should be in prison. I mean, she put so many people at risk and knowingly did it and did not care. It was all about her image and her power grab.
Well, yeah, and purposefully siloed departments from each other, former employees from current employees. Like, she had numerous opportunities just in terms of fundraising rounds to be like, I should quit while I'm behind and stop the charade. But she never chose that. It was always like, well, let's go to a different group of, you know, older father figures that I can suck up to and see how we do with that.
And you have to wonder how did she think this was going to end? Did she think she'd eventually create the technology that she was saying she was going to create? Or did she think she'd just be able to indefinitely string people along while accruing power and money. I mean, it's just,
I mean, it doesn't seem to have been necessarily about the money. Like, she declined to be involved in the book at all. Shocker. So we don't have her side, but I, based on what they were like, repeated interactions with the engineers where they're like, what you want to do isn't possible.
Right.
And she's like, we need to change the size of X. And she's, and she would refuse to consider it. That I think she just wanted this thing that she thought of to be possible to invent using current technology, and sort of not realizing, like, well, we don't, we're not there yet. Like, as a,
right,
as an engineering species, like, you're going to have to wait.
Well, she was never told no,
yeah,
like, her whole life. So, you know, she lives in a fantasy world where anything she wants to happen should happen.
Yeah.
And people enabled her in that for a really long time.
Yeah.
That's what's scary.
Because they didn't want to get screamed at by Sonny, or because they didn't want to lose their jobs, or because they didn't want the, like, full court David Boies press to happen to them. I mean, I don't blame anyone for sort of being like, I won't work here anymore because I ethically can't, but then not going any further, because everybody, I think, looked at each other and thought, well, surely somebody else is going to notice.
Yeah.
That she had,
or the, there must be information that I don't have about how this works.
Yeah, exactly. You had a couple clips that you wanted to share. What is our next one highlighting?
So the next one is about, she hired a really fancy marketing firm called Chiat Day. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly,
but I think so. I think it's, like, the only marketing firm anyone's ever heard of. So it's, yeah.
Well, yeah. And they're very prestigious, and they did, like, an all over marketing campaign, including redoing the website. So this is from page 163 to 164 of the book. By the summer of 2013, as Chiat Day scrambled to ready the Theranos website for the company's commercial launch, the 4S, aka the Mini Lab, had been under development for more than 2.5 years. But the device remained very much a work in progress. The list of its problems were lengthy. The biggest problem of all was the dysfunctional corporate culture in which it was being developed. Elizabeth and Sonny regarded anyone who raised a concern or an objection as a cynic and a naysayer. Employees who persisted in doing so were usually marginalized or fired, while sycophants were promoted. When I read that, all I could think was Trump administration.
Uh-huh.
So Al and I, my husband and I, watched it must have been the Leah Remini Scientology series. And we were like, this is just like Trump. So everything always relates back to Trump.
It's true.
For me these days. But whenever there's, like, a dysfunctional, like, culture of silence and, like, marginalizing those who think differently or have questions, I'm like, Trump. And that seems to be what was happening in Theranos to, like, a extreme degree. Anyone who even had a personal disagreement with her, it seemed, was, or with Sonny, was out the door.
Yeah.
And they made sure, the company made sure that employees were not allowed to take any data with them, to the point where they threatened people with, like, devastating legal action if they found out that they'd even emailed themselves anything from the company. So that's why they were able to keep it quiet for so long.
Yeah. Well, and there's, I mean, as the years are sort of rolling by and the company keeps existing and being able to pay hundreds of people salaries and rent the building Facebook used to use for headquarters and on and on and on, you're like, how is this possible? But this is how. And it wasn't a public company, so
there's no accountability.
There was no accountability. And, you know, she did have a con person's unerring instinct for how far she can, like, push and threaten and, you know, wear out her opponents, like, financially in terms of wanting to fight her. You had one more clip that illustrated the dangers of involving politicians in their 90s in your whistleblowing.
So we had talked earlier about how she was able to just kind of mesmerize these old white dudes who had a lot of levers of power, who were basically able to give her the aura of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Credibility that she needed. I mean, because she's a young, untested college dropout. And so she had all these very respected military and political leaders saying, like, yes, she is the way of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And George Shultz in particular, who, as you said, it was in his 90s and was completely convinced of her genius and would not be dissuaded from it, even when his grandson Tyler, who had worked within the company and had seen some shit, was like, Grandpa, like, this, she's, no, that, like, this company is not what it says it is. She doesn't have this technology. And he just wouldn't listen. So this is from page 199 of the book. George Shultz said a top surgeon in New York had told him the company was going to revolutionize the field of surgery. No, by the way. And this was someone his good friend Henry Kissinger considered to be the smartest man alive. And according to Elizabeth, Theranos' devices were already being used in medevac helicopters and hospital operating rooms, so they must be working. Tyler, that's George Shultz's grandson, and Erica, who was his colleague at Theranos, tried to tell him that couldn't possibly be true, given that the devices were barely working within the walls of Theranos. But it was clear they weren't making any headway. George urged them to put the company behind them and to move on with their lives. They both had bright futures ahead, he told them. They left the dinner frustrated with little choice but to follow his advice. And that was it. I mean, they tried. And then,
like,
Tyler ended up being a whistleblower.
What is the point of having grandparents if they're not always going to be on your side no matter what? Like, that was just so sad. I'm just imagining this, like, you know, floppy-haired kid who had some kind of, like, chemical engineering degree, no? Like, he was not a joke, this kid.
Yeah, he was smart.
Yeah. Being like, Grandpa, like, I know you really like her. And then the way that that family, like, she'd be at Thanksgiving and no one would tell him. And then he'd come and see her, whatever, Prius in the driveway and be like, God damn it. It's like her.
They chose her over him.
Yeah.
So it's really sad.
I mean, at least Tyler's step grandma was like, George, what are you doing? And, like, eventually threw some of the lawyers out of the house on his behalf, but I think it, like, was basically never resolved between them. It's
but they
just
tried
so shitty.
It is shitty, and they tried to entrap Tyler at one point to get him to sign these documents. They basically, George Shultz agreed with these lawyers to ambush his grandson to try to stop the grandson from whistleblowing, which is insane.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, that was very exciting. And then, like, the next chapter is Carrie Rue being like, I had no idea any of this was happening. All I knew was Tyler had gone dark. And then he moves on to something else. And the whole time I was wondering, like, is, you know, what is Tyler doing? Is he okay?
Yeah.
Like, in the back of your mind, it's like he's going to get a coffee and then someone from this law firm is surveilling him. And I mean, ugh, like, these, most of these people are extremely shitty, but there are a couple of heroes in the book, and the book is a complete hero. I think this is the best true crime that I've read in a while.
It's great.
So
yes.
Definitely, I definitely recommend it. Folks, put it on your Amazon wish list, put it on your library hold list. It's great, and it's exactly the right length. It's, the footnotes are not intrusive. Carrie Rue has only written this one book, and he really needs to get cracking on a bunch more, because this was great.
Yeah.
Where else can listeners find you, Stephanie?
You can find me on my website, stephanieearlygreen.com, and I'm on Twitter at Teffi, E-T-E-F-F-I.
Very good. Thanks again for coming on today.
Thanks, Sarah.
Got a tip for the Blotter Presents? As I said, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. You can become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. And you can also advertise on this fine podcast. Look me up on advertisecast.com. Do you like the podcast? Please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. Do you not like the podcast? Tell no one. My guest has been Stephanie Green, and she is on Twitter at Eteffi, E-T-E-F-F-I. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.